We welcome back to our podcast a former guest, Leonard McMahon, who is an assistant professor of pastoral care, spirituality, and political theology at Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley, and also founder and CEO of Common Ground Dialogue, a political consulting firm specializing in facilitating conversation around complicated social issues, bringing together divergent communities. Leonard is the Faith and Imagination Lecturer at BYU this semester, and he'll be speaking to us about peace building, a spiritual practice, and also a vital but endangered art in our fractious, polarized age. I'm Matthew Wickman of BYU Faith and Imagination Institute.
Democracy is built for conflict. It's built for disagreement. Somehow, some way, the culture has shifted to the point where everybody thinks that in order to have community, we have to have agreement. Disagreement is what is the soil of which community grows, as a matter of fact. Of course, we know the scripture, where two or more are gathered, there I am also, as Jesus is saying. What does that mean? It means that where two, at least one and another person, that's just two, not to mention more, are present, then that's where difference arises, and out of that difference comes love.
So, Leonard, it's great to talk with you again on the podcast. It's great to see you in person, as a matter of fact.
Absolutely. This is great. I'm so glad we were able to do this.
Yeah, so, Leonard, you're in town. You're the Faith and Imagination Lecturer for this semester. We do this once a semester, yeah. These Faith and Imagination Lectures. And you were on the podcast, what, about a year and a half, two years ago, is that right?
Something like that, yeah.
So, and a lot's changed in the world in the last, I think these years, every couple years is like total transformation and something.
Right.
And so your area is peace building, peacemaking. Well, spirituality, pastoral care, and political theology. But a lot of your work these days is on peacemaking, peace building, which is certainly something we need to talk about today. And so thank you for being here to share your expertise and wisdom.
Absolutely.
Grateful to you.
No, thank you. Thank you so much, Matt, for the invitation and for the hospitality. It's been wonderful. I'm glad we could sit across the table and talk about these issues. Yeah, where do you want to start?
Well, it's nice to not be on Zoom, first of all, I will say.
Yeah,
that.
Exactly.
So let me start here. So some of our listeners might remember you from our last episode. And for those who've forgotten or those who are new to the podcast, I'll remind people that you work in, again, areas of pastoral care, spirituality, and political theology. And much of your work involves what you describe as improving the common good.
Yes.
Right? And you run a consultancy firm called Common Ground Consultancy. As we talk here in 2025, with all the animosity and even the trauma that informs our public discourse, I'm interested in how you even think of a phrase today like common ground. I mean, would you say that the shared space of social life, this common ground, is a shrinking territory, or is it larger than many of us might think?
Oh, I think it's as large as the human experience itself. I think it's as large as the field of humanity itself, and as large as God, if you will, for those for whom that resonates. So I think there's common ground. I think there's always possibilities and capabilities that people have that just haven't tapped into it. So what I do with Common Ground Dialogue is just to help people understand the capacity, deepen the capacity and the awareness to do the work of relationship building, right? Either it's interpersonal or across groups or across, you know, major constituencies, whatever it is. I want to help people realize their potential for community. So let me also back up and say a little bit about Common Ground. The name is an homage to Howard Thurman, who has a book called On Common Ground. And so I'm definitely want to pay homage to him. He's an inspiration.
He's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. So much of this comes from him and his writings, his work. And the impetus, again, is it starts with the premise that democracy is my preferred form of government. I'll just say that up front. I can own that. Democracy is built for conflict. It's built for disagreement. Somehow, some way, the culture has shifted to the point where everybody thinks that in order to have community, we have to have agreement. Disagreement is what is the soil of which community grows. As a matter of fact, of course, we know the scripture where two or more are gathered, there I am also, as Jesus is saying. What does that mean? It means that where two, at least one and another person, that's just two, not to mention more, are present, then that's where difference arises, and out of that difference comes love. Mm. So Christ is talking about himself. That's where I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what I like about that is you're talking about kind of common ground fashioned out of what begins from uncommon experiences.
Absolutely.
Or I mean uncommon in this, not common human experience, but different ways of being situated in the world.
Yes.
Different ways of relating to other people or yes. the world around us. Yeah. It's that actually uncommonness which is the basis for commonality that you are seeking
Absolutely.
To establish. Okay.
It's a bit of wordplay, the title. The name is, so I don't mean there's a common ground that we all share together. Like there's some ground that we have to discover.
Yeah, okay.
That if we, as long as we reach that, then we're in common. No, what I mean is there's, all of us have a ground in a sense that that's what we hold in common. All of us have a ground that's deep in our particularity, our individuality, our context and all this. All of us are uniquely who we are and no one else. And out of that, we can dialogue about what we have in common and what we need to.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Mm-hmm. Let me just for a minute, this is not devil's advocate. It's just yeah. a different position that takes a, I'm going to play the simpleton for a minute uh-huh. and take a different version of common ground.
Sure.
One that's not nearly as sophisticated as what you just explained.
Okay.
All right. Uh-huh. Might I say that common ground in the sense of commonality
yeah.
is harder to find across groups.
Mm-hmm.
That are differently situated
mm-hmm.
and that common ground, as we often think about it, shared experiences mm-hmm. where we have the same ideas and beliefs mm-hmm. about things,
mm-hmm.
that common ground in some ways is shrinking. And I'm wondering whether polarization, in some ways paradoxically,
mm-hmm.
Doesn't only make social life harder, it also makes it easier in the sense that people only have to deal with folks from their own tribe.
Yes.
Right? And I mean, if that's true, where the assumption now is that common ground means your tribal fellows,
yeah.
does that make the kind of deeper common ground that you're looking to cultivate mm-hmm. harder to find? Or is it actually that kind of polarization that makes it possible? Does that make sense? Is it, I mean, yeah. if the commonality you're seeking is formed from differences, when the differences grow more intense,
mm-hmm.
does that make it easier to do the work that you want to do or harder?
Both. And it depends on the persons involved, whether or not it's easier or harder. The intensification of the difference and difficulty is more opportunity for the community to be built. But one has to have the capacity to do that. And it is always a choice. Something I'll talk about later when we do a lecture, is there's always a choice and a chance when it comes to difference in community. It's always a choice and a chance, and the responsibility is ours. See, there's no magic here in the sense of the bad sense of magic. There's no, this isn't the movies, we're not crafting. This is real life. And we always have to take responsibility for the life that we're living as much as we can. We can't control other people, but we can control ourselves. So I really want people to understand that polarization is sort of an extreme way of describing group affinities, right? That don't want to engage each other. It's a mediated term, right? You only polarize because you're separated. But honestly, there really is no such thing as polarization when it comes to people and their capacity for community.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's only a penultimate, anti-penultimate kind of existence. And the affinity you mentioned where people are in the tribes, those tribes have a lot of differences remaining in them. So of course we know yeah. René Girard and the idea of scapegoating and so on and so forth. And so all these kinds of things. And so we will use this called tribes are based on a kind of mutual distrust of something else. But it's a false affinity.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about that from the standpoint of a couple other ideas that kind of play with the idea of common ground.
Okay.
That kind of comes from different Christian angles, different right. things that one hears in Christian circles, right?
Right,
so
right.
A former guest on the podcast a few years ago is mm-hmm. an Australian theologian named Sarah Batchelard,
right.
now a good friend. And she has this beautiful book called Experiencing God in Time of Crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And she writes that we humans are an idolatrous species,
mm-hmm.
okay? That we can't help but make idols out of the things we most value.
Mm-hmm.
And especially this is true of God, mm-hmm. right? And she claims that God, at a practical level for people,
mm-hmm.
Often serves as a projection of our own values,
mm-hmm.
that we invoke God to affirm what we believe,
mm-hmm.
What we think is right,
mm-hmm.
to affirm the stories that we're living, the histories that we like, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
In actuality, Sarah says, when God breaks into our lives, it's usually to reveal that we're living some kind of illusion, that God reveals our limitations, our human foibles. He says the story you're living is incomplete, actually. The point of view that you're holding is not fully my own, you know, that there's a gap between you and where I am. Therefore, you're living somewhat in an illusion, and God reveals these illusions to us. From that perspective, Sarah Bachelard's perspective, her Christian perspective, was to say that the aim for our politics would not be to sort of find common ground in the form of consensus, but rather to find common ground in the form of conversion. It's finding common ground that is common ground as two people or more, two groups, are in process of transformation.
Yes.
You hear that, do you say that's exactly right, or do you say that's pie in the sky, or do you say that's wrong someplace? What do you think when you hear that idea?
That's exactly right. And so what I do in the studies and teaching and all that is about how that gets done. One of my theses is that everyone knows what to do. I mean, in a sense, there's a lot of great work being done. People are pulling from where they are and who they are to contribute to solving these problems. And that's fantastic, and I love to hear this. Where I particularly want to emphasize is how it actually happens. How does one do that? So this is why I talk about the grounding. And so that would be the point where you say God, given what you just described, God comes in and shows you the illusory nature of whatever it is you believed, right? And breaks open all that. And I agree around idols. And so here's where I go with the idolatry. Here's my definition of it. Idolatry is what you treat, what you regard as godlike in the same way that it's a mystery that you will not speak on. So what I approach is the apophatic nature of idols. Right?
Apophatic, just for listeners who might be familiar with that term, apophatic means?
Well, the mystical nature, or the, you know, without words, a kind of contemplative nature.
Right.
And it's the thing that one is silent upon. So if one's, you know, meditating on God, you reach a point where, you know, you can't talk about God. That's the thing I can't talk about. That's the more apophatic, you know, level, dimension. But there are a number of things that we hold as idols that we don't talk about. Across the board, right? Across the board. I mean, again, when I say across the board, I mean demographically and race, class, gender, sexuality, whatever it might be. Across the board, all of us have idols that we don't talk about. And so the work I do is to help deepen the vulnerability and awareness it takes to become aware of those idols. And then from that place, engage the conversation across difference. Because then my confidence, whatever position I held prior to that point, is a different kind of confidence. I might still believe it needs to be a wall on the border, but it won't be from the same way I said it the first time.
Okay. Yeah. So really what you're saying is this common ground isn't necessarily a function of utterly changing positions on an issue, but changing the way that we see and think about it.
Exactly.
Alongside those who may not see it exactly as we do.
Exactly. Yeah.
So demographically, I mean, you're not a sociologist.
No.
Though you can certainly play one here if you want to.
Okay, great.
Okay.
I'll try.
You got a full license, to play sociology. Someone like me, so I'm in my mid to late 50s, white, male, religious. My religion compels me to do things that are difficult things.
Yes.
It also provides me the consolation in my life. What are idols someone in my demographic category might have? College professor, you know, I mean, not wealthy, but I'm certainly got a stable financial existence. What are things that you might look at in someone like me and say, Matt, I'll bet you the things you won't talk about, or things that you think you have resolved but probably aren't,
yes,
might fall into what kinds of categories?
So categorically, I mean, it'd be hard to do. It would take conversation, which is, again, part of the methodology I'm using, but class would be one.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
Like I think I'm enlightened. I think that I'm just so very cognizant of the plight of those from other classes, but might not be. I project my values onto other people. Is that kind of what I might do if I were this idolatrous person?
Well, it's just that it's the thing that you want to become aware of, so that while you're in relationships, you can't change who you are.
Right.
I wouldn't suggest that. You know, you want to. Although maybe some people might think that's appropriate, but no, you can't change who you are. Be who you are, but know what that is. And the only way you actually find that out would be in conversation, in the community. See, that's the other thing about this work.
Okay.
It's a kind of meditation, but not solitary.
Okay.
Not isolated. It's done in relationship. So I'm helping you, if I were working with you through Common Ground dialogue, I would be helping you explore those various places, those unknown places, that darkness.
Okay.
Yeah.
Exploring darkness. This sounds a lot like contemplative, like a contemplative practice, like a spiritual practice.
That's exactly what it is.
What would that kind of exercise we just went through help me understand in a way that would make me a better listener to people who feel differently than I?
It softens you. Hopefully, okay. Ostensibly. And of course, this is just a little brief moment here.
Yeah.
But the idea is it softens the edges.
Yeah.
Softens the edges, and it makes us aware of our growing edges. And that's all I really want.
That's good. I like that a lot. Because, yeah. I mean, I think it's easy to sort of understand people. You know, you could predict many things about me on the basis of my, you know, kind of like a place in society. You could guess how I... what I think about the importance of education, you guess what I think about certain kinds of funding for education, you could guess maybe candidates at the local or national that I like more than others, you could guess many things. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you could also guess people who feel differently from me.
Mm-hmm.
But this exercise would be one that would reveal that inside all of my, you know, positions, mm-hmm. positionalities that mm-hmm. are places of supposed strength, there's a lot of mm-hmm. human vulnerability and mm-hmm. weakness there, yeah. right, that has its own kind of fragile exactly. stories
exactly.
that prop it up
yeah.
and its own coming to terms of things that are difficult
yeah.
for me to accept
yeah.
And work with, and that would make me then more open, I suppose, to other people, even those who come
yeah.
Something differently than I do or feel very differently about it. We recognize each other in the fragility of our stories. What does that mean, though, when you confront somebody who does not feel at all fragile? Say I become aware of my own fragility, my
mm-hmm.
vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
And I confront somebody who could not be more certain and more confident.
Mm.
What recourse, how does one find common ground when only one partner feels as though we need to?
Yeah, just as in a relationship of any kind, or say a marriage or committed relationship of any kind, it takes two. And it's always two. That is something that is part of being, it's part of Christian life, Christian living. It's part of being, you know, a person as a teacher or a helper or anything like that. The possibility of rejection is always there. You cannot control the other person. So all I aim to do with this work is just offer the opportunity. And I tend to not work with groups who don't seem ready to do that yet.
Okay.
It would be unproductive and cynical of me to do that, right? It'd be like, well, I'm just performing for you something. But so when I go in, I try to have an assessment of, okay, how ready are you to be vulnerable to each other and to yourself? And that's always a possibility, though. Somebody might not want to change the position because you can always pop out, right? So let me just kind of, I'm doing my hands here, make it sort of a diagram. If you start at the surface level and then you reach a point a little deeper and you hit a conflict, if you can stay there, stay connected in the conflict, stay available, stay present, and you reach the point, you move through that to another level of community yeah. down there. But anytime you hit that conflict and things start to get deep, it's always a possibility someone will pop back out to the surface. That's the, if you will, spiritual excavation that needs to happen.
Yeah, okay. Let me ask you, so you mentioned you have to be able to face rejection
yeah.
and to take rejection.
Yeah.
Do you find it's harder to teach students to be vulnerable, or is it harder to teach them to try again after rejection?
Coming, number one, just being honest to myself and coming out of the African-American experience and Black experience and so on, and coming out of that, and then joining up with other, in solidarity with other justice seekers and other people, and so on. Those might be two moments in the same life. Always being willing to, once one achieves a certain kind of vulnerability and sees that one's life is an act of grace, right? One is just given an act of grace, there's a kind of softness there. Then always being open to relationship with other people across difference and being compassionate. See, both of those, I think, cohere in compassion for me. I guess that's where I'm, and it's a wonderful sort of parsing out of these two elements, but both are acts of compassion. In order to have compassion, one must understand that one first needs and have self-compassion. So the thing I always tell students is the source of all compassion is self-compassion. Mm. Start there, right? And students do. They develop that capacity and that gratitude and that humility, if you will. Genuine humility, not long suffering, not redemptive suffering, anything like that. Genuine humility. Appreciation, and then are willing to extend it to other people in a judicious and prudential way that's effective and appropriate for the person, right? I'm not a punching bag, right? I don't make myself into a punching bag, but I become available because I know what it's like to suffer. I've been there. I've explored that. I know myself, in as much as anyone can, through the feedback of other people. But it allows me to stay open and be compassionate.
Nice. Mentioned I had a couple of these Christian positions I want to ask you about. One was Sarah Batchelard's about idol making, and about God breaking through and breaking down our idols and our illusions. Mm-hmm. Here's another one. I'm curious what you think about common ground from this perspective here. Something that I occasionally read from thoughtful Christian writers is the idea that, you know, much as Christ claimed to have no home, right? Determined and discipled Christians have no political party, right? Jesus said, you know, what's that line in the book Gospel of Matthew? The Son of Man hath no place to lay his head, right? Mm-hmm. And the thinking here would be that Christians can draw good ideas from different political parties. Mm-hmm. All along the political spectrum, they can draw good ideas, but that they really, at core, should remain strangers to all of them.
Absolutely.
Right? Mm-hmm. And this, from this perspective, common ground, at least among disciple Christians, right, would only be found outside the territory claimed by left or right. Does that kind of perspective ring true to you, or is that in its own way blinkered by its own illusions?
Yeah, I wouldn't say outside of the fields of political fields. There's a temptation there to etherealize, you know, spiritual life and disembody it in a certain kind of way, right? Yeah. So no, we're all embodied creatures. And so no, we create politics as a human creation, and we have to do it in order to get through life. So not apart from that, but always with a sense of, in and of itself, my existence is not reduced to this, whatever activities I'm doing with my, you know, with my existence. It's not reduced to that. There's always potential for something else. So the genius, for example, just again, I mentioned being black, in the genius of the black community, black tradition, the moral genius is that, as Howard Thurman notes, it invites a third party into a difficult conversation with an unwelcoming world. That's what you bring God in. And Howard Thurman, you read Jesus and Disinherited, says that holds a moral standard, not only for the other person, it only provides a lens to get to the person who's hating me and whatever, but it also it's a standard for me in the sense that I have to conduct myself in a way that's honest to this particular faith that I have. Right? I can't engage in power manipulations and machinations just to win the day, the political moment.
Right.
I've got something else. I've got a character. I've got a way of being in the world. Yeah.
You mentioned Howard Thurman, and you know Thurman much, much better than I do, but I've read and I love the book, Jesus and the Disinherited.
Yes.
Let me ask you, there's an idea from that book and a quote from that book I found very compelling when I read it. I'd love to know your thoughts on it. This is a 1976 book, for those who might be familiar with this book, Jesus and the Disinherited. And he writes there, Thurman does, about how Jesus, you know, as a Jew, was poor and part of a minority group. He was a victim of racial hatred, right, in his own time. But in the midst of all this, Thurman says, I'm going to quote here from this, Jesus' message, I'm quoting Thurman, focused on the urgency of a radical change in the inner attitude of the people. The kingdom of heaven is in us. This was Jesus' message. It was but natural that such a position would be deeply resented by many of his fellows who were suffering even as he was. To them, this message was a complete betrayal to the enemy, a counsel of acquiescence, if not of despair.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a strong, mm-hmm. strong word, strong message, strong idea about Jesus. My questions here are twofold. Do you agree with Thurman? And if you think of Thurman's writing this not in 1976, but in 2025, he would say the same thing. Or would he say that times have changed such that it's a different part of the Christian message or perspective that we need to have in present times?
Yeah. No. Yeah, no, someone like Thurman or King or someone like that, those geniuses would not have, they wouldn't be, you know, sort of buying into all the hype and so on. They wouldn't buy into the polarization, to use that word.
How would they get by? In a world where what choice is there? I guess that's something a lot of people feel like. You have no tribe, you got nothing. How would you, I'm not breaking into your question, but it's just, I think what you're saying rings true.
Yeah.
And I love the image of a Martin Luther King or a Howard Thurman not being a part of that entire model.
Yeah.
It just gets hard to imagine given where we're actually at.
Well, then there's a fan of Hamer, by the way. Whenever I mention King, I got to mention Hamer. Those two, they go to the synonymous. I always try to remember to do that. Because and Hamer, it was even a greater moral achievement because she had less resources, right? He wasn't educated and so on.
Yeah,
he wasn't middle class and was poor sharecropper. But so Hamer has an incident where she recounts an incident where she says, I can't see the face of God in hate, right? So when they get by, and so it's really, no, it's powerful. And I'm looking at you, I'm sincerely, and I believe, and I hear you on the question. But I almost want to go, how am I sitting here with you right now if someone didn't get by? You're talking about my ancestors with slavery and then segregation. You got Jim Crow. You got all kinds of death surrounding you and also perpetuating death within the community and to each other and all this.
Right.
How do you get here but for the fact that someone was able to find a way through out of no way?
Yeah, right,
you make a way out of no way.
Nice.
So you have a tradition. That's why I'm so much tribe, but you have a tradition that you lean on, and we all have these attachments. You named very clearly the LDS community and the cultural attachments and things. Those sustain us when our intellect, or our intelligence rather, this thing that helps allows us that we think we can control the world, this sort of myth of self-mastery, right? And the mastery of others. Security, status, money, power, control, all those things. When those things run out, what's left?
So you think if Thurman were writing today, he'd have the same message?
Yeah, he would say it clearly. Yeah, he would be like, well, what's changed? You know, what's different? This is life. I mean, it's always an interesting question. People who died, and of course he didn't, he died in 81, so he wasn't that young. I mean, he had a full life. But someone like King or even Malcolm, you wonder where they would be, you know, 30 years later.
Yeah.
What they would do now, but I feel confident in saying, given the life they live, that they would cling to those traditions. That's the kind of vulnerability I'm talking about. It's hard to describe, I mean, even with words, because you can notice even my language here, I'm moving into an apophatic moment, because the words begin to fail when I'm trying to get at this quality of vulnerability, these tears, these moans, these groans, and why, and why, and why, and how long, oh Lord, how long will you keep your face from me? I mean, I believe, but I don't know. That kind of feeling, see, and a lot of us, I think, might be new to some of us in this moment, in this political moments, in the pandemic, and now with the election and so on. This kind of thing might be new, but it's not new in human history. We've been through this before. Where are our resources? That, can I just say real quickly? That's part of the problem of the modern culture. We need vulnerability to get through this moment. That's the only way to get through, if you want to say get by, get through. But we have a culture of invulnerability that won't let us access
exactly.
the greatness that, you know, was bequeathed to us by many who came before.
Yeah, it's a culture of power.
It's a culture of power.
And a culture of invulnerability.
Invulnerability.
Right, a culture of force.
Exactly.
And this comes from, I think, I'm sure, a feeling of extreme vulnerability, right?
That's
we are losing our sense of fill in the blank, whatever this may be.
Yes.
Therefore, we are with backs to the wall. We are fighting with all we've got. You know, and this is creating... It's exacerbating the tensions.
Oh my God, there's a documentary. The reason I'm smiling right now is there's a documentary on Howard Thurman named People With Their Backs to the Wall.
Wall.
Yeah.
That's a phrase that he uses.
Exactly. And see, but you see the choice he makes, the moral choices he makes to deal with that condition.
That's right.
So what are we gonna do? We have a choice and a chance here.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, let me invoke another figure here. This one is the president of my church. The president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Russell M. Nelson, gave a really, I thought it was a very inspiring talk 2 years ago on peacemaking.
Yeah.
And this is, I'm quoting him here, just a little paragraph, and I've got a couple questions for you about this. Mm-hmm. He writes and spoke these words, "Before his death, the Savior commanded his 12 apostles to love one another as he had loved them." And then he added, "By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another." And then President Nelson continues, "The Savior's message is clear. His true disciples build, lift, encourage, persuade, and inspire, no matter how difficult the situation. True disciples of Jesus Christ are peacemakers."
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a couple questions.
Mm-hmm.
First, does that sound right to you? And then second question, and the more difficult one, what in your personal experience, or perhaps your learning about this subject, does it mean to, in President Nelson's words, build, lift, encourage, persuade, and inspire, okay, when the discussions are not only difficult, but seem nearly impossible, right? What does that look like?
Yes, no, thank you. Thank you for turning me on to President Nelson's address. I did watch the whole thing. It's a wonderful, wonderful speech. And I think he's right. And again, I love to see all these different voices coming together to help speak to the moment. And each of us is part of a chorus, and we all, you know, we need every voice to be speaking. Let's see, what's an example of peacemaking in the way that he's describing? I'll share this one moment. So the day after the election, the election was one day, and the day after the election, I ended up talking with a friend who voted differently from me. And I got to tell you, that day after the election, I told this person, I said, I need a day. I need a minute. I just need a moment to collect myself. But I remember that person, she told me, you know, I voted the way I voted because I felt condescended to by those on the other side. Mm. And I had to really sit with that. I mean, there was a moment I said, I thank you for that, and I just need a day. And the next day I did. I came back into the conversation. And I told her, I hear you. Whether I agree or disagree, right or wrong, it's not the point. She was vulnerable enough to share those feelings. Someone told me that they felt belittled. And this was an action they felt they could take to regain some sense of esteem or agency. Do I disagree? Of course. I disagreed. But the capacity to hear that, right, and to stay in relationship with that person, to connect with that person. I'm not putting in the category of a hamer or anybody like that or a king, but there was a moment there where I was able to do that. And I think that's what President Nelson's talking about.
Yeah, good. I think that is. Yeah. I think that is what he's talking about.
Yeah.
It's about not letting our divisions keep us from hearing each other.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to really kind of grapple with the reality of our collective humanity and, you know, our commonness as children of God.
Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. So in your experience on the ground and in teaching these things to your students, what do you think, if a student really puts their mind and heart to peace building, what are some virtues that you think this practice tends to cultivate?
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, are there virtues that difficult work in peace building can almost erode. Mm. For example, does it make people less hopeful to come up against again and again and again against those who don't agree with them? Does it make them angrier and not just more inclined to listen, and so forth? I mean, what virtues are you cultivating, and are there virtues that are maybe almost challenged by this very difficult work of peace building?
Oh, absolutely. I think all the virtues that I would name would be challenged by peacemaking. Absolutely. No, that's going to happen. Again, I want to be very clear here. I don't want to sell a movie. This isn't movie magic. This isn't a fantasy. This is real life, and it's going to cost something. So I love the film that we were able to see together yesterday at the Church History Museum about the
First Vision.
A
5-minute short video about this,
It's a beautiful thing, and I want to talk more about that in the lecture, but just for here, I'd say, so it ends with this, the First Vision is the pearl of great price, right? And so I'm always curious. I mean, I know there's a whole lot of LDS theology to go into here, and I love that, but I guess I'm just on the first hearing, I'm a pearl of great price. Means that whatever the pearl is, it's valuable, okay, I get that, but why is the price so great? What was the price? Mm. What was the price paid? To do with the darkness beforehand, right? And Joseph Smith sitting there in the darkness, and see, that's the other question about it. It's a 5-minute video, but I would love to know how long was he out there in those woods?
I'd like to know that too.
How long were you out there, man? By yourself out there?
Right.
Yeah. So you quoted just a minute ago, you talked about President Nelson's address, and he used the Bible verse and mentions disciples of Christ.
Yeah.
And the word disciple, coming from the word discipline,
and
which is from the Latin discere, which means to learn in the typical sense we might use it now, right? To learn something, go in discipline. But really, and even in the classical setting, it was a full body learning. It was a way of connecting with something that what I wanted to become or what I wanted to be.
Good.
Crafting, self-crafting, soul-crafting. So the disciplines that he names in that Bible verse, to build, lift, and I forget the other ones you named, those would be practices designed to craft a certain soul, right? To make me into a certain kind of person that could then do this work and sustain in the face of rejection and no, and the hard work of peace building. And last thing to say on this, Hebrews 11:13. And people know this to be the litany of faith, if you will. But there's a line there where it says, and they died without receiving, these faithful, they died without receiving what was promised. Mm. And they remained foreigners and strangers on the earth. Mm. And they were okay. So you might not get it. It might not happen. You got to be willing to. I mean, Hamer died penniless, poor. Sick, King, Malcolm, all these people. In our culture today, that is anathema. There'd be no way. I got to make my money and make my millions and, you know, be a big thing and be a celebrity and famous and on social media and everybody's got to like me and all the rest of it. Oh my goodness, what a different model than what we, you know, that, so I weep sometimes when I hear that, you know, I see some of the young generation think that that's how you're supposed to be in the world. Stop there.
Yeah, no, that's profound. In other words, there have to be a way in which these virtues are the type that point you to what beyond the limits of what you can understand in an immortal way.
Yeah.
And they point you back to some kind of darkness of what's beyond your experience that you have to sort of go through. Yeah. What you said about that etymology, so disciple from discipline, you know, from the Latin discere, is it the same root as the word discernment?
That's a good question.
I'm just wondering if those are related. Because it'd be interesting if it's like
it would
discerning,
be.
Right?
Yeah, it would be, yeah.
Recognizing the one, you know, in this case, to follow Christ is also to identify, to recognize who Christ is.
Yeah, I would imagine so from the learning.
Yeah, you would think, right?
Yeah.
And that would be interesting here to add, because it suggests that that is a process, as you point out, it's full-bodied. It's not just an intellectual process.
Right.
It's about a process of kind of following, you know, walking after in ways that are inherently difficult. And rigorous and challenging and unsettling, literally, moving from here to there, unsettling oneself and getting out of one's place and going somewhere out.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I love that, the connection with discernment. I think that's probably correct. I mean, the idea of learning and staying connected to something over time? And how do you, you know, oh, here's the other thing though about it, about a market culture that we live in. We are all under certain kinds of disciplines. Believe it, whether or not we're aware of it, we are disciplined, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is a critique of, you know, I don't want to go too far here into Marx and so on and so forth. But I mean, this is a critique again that capitalist structures will discipline people, will discipline all people involved in it to become certain kinds of people. And what I hope is simply that when we're born, we don't just simply live lives of either consumers or, you know, workers or producers or whatever, right? Just, you know, makers and takers, that we are givers of somehow. But you have to have something to give.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've got a couple more questions here for mm-hmm. you. And you teach pastoral care,
mm-hmm.
and I'm presently a bishop in my congregation, and that's largely a calling off pastoral care. It's like the,
yes.
the head minister of a yeah. parish or something yeah. like this is what yeah. this would be, a local congregation. From your vantage point as a scholar, do you see the broad cultural needs for pastoral care changing?
Yeah.
If so, do you see the field that you study as a scholar mm-hmm. changing in light of those needs, or is the field resisting the change?
Oh, no, it's fully changed right now. So I teach courses with names like Pastoral Care from Marginalized Bodies, For and With Marginalized Bodies, and another course called Who Cares? ? It's a wonderful play on words there. The idea of who am I to care? How do I become, you know, a person who cares? And the whole field has changed. The original model, if you will, let's say original model, would be a psychotherapeutic model. One-on-one, I talk with you, and I help you find ways of coping with whatever it is that's going on in your life. Now, that's not even how it's done anymore. I mean, justice work and justice concerns are thoroughly saturated the field. It's even adopting some things like case method from, you know, other kinds of disciplines like business school, law school, or whatever. And care studies is really taking off. Chaplaincies, you can find chaplains in just about every field. There's Hollywood chaplaincies. NASCAR has chaplains.
I want to be a NASCAR chaplain.
Exactly, right? Yeah, right, right. I mean, yeah. I'd be very, you know, very cool. It's a very cool yeah. thing. And of course, government and other kinds of services. But yeah, chaplaincy is a very, very powerful set of skills. I teach it as, again, the way to make all the other ideas that I think are should be, the way life should be and who I should be, make all those possible and real.
Okay.
Put it like this, coming from the PSR perspective, and again, progressive Christian perspective. If a student is studying decoloniality, right, decolonial ethics or decolonial theory, or and then also postcolonial theory or queer theology or, you know, black theology or whatever it is, right, if you learn how to care correctly, all that's already happens. It's built into it. It's impossible to care and be colonial. It's impossible to care and be, we get too far up here, but it's impossible to care and not be black in a way, right? It's a gift of black mm-hmm. theology to give out of that unique set of experiences, which are not reducible, they can't be transferable, it's non-transferable good, right? It's a set of experiences, but I can share lessons and things that I'm learning, have learned as a black person to other people who are not black.
Right.
So that would be black theology and black thinking. But care work is what does all that. Yeah, you learn how to care, everything else was taken care of.
Yeah, something I've noticed about you, Leonard, I've known you. You are you're a very good listener, mm-hmm. and I can tell that you've really adopted a lot of these virtues and practices that you teach and preach, which I really appreciate. You know, this being a Christian means coming across people from very different places mm-hmm. along, kind of life's spectrum of experiences. Upper class, lower class, you know, white, black, you name it, you know, all different kinds of differences. And I really appreciate what you bring to this conversation and field. You are the semester's Faith and Imagination lecturer. I want to give our listeners a little sneak, from me, a sneak preview of what you're going to be saying a little bit later today.
Sure. Yeah, the title of the lecture is Democratic Dispositions, Keeping the Faith and Living Together in Our Post-Election World. And each part of that will be talked about, particularly keeping the faith. How does one hold one's faith and hold to one's convictions, keep to one's disciplines, whatever those are, and live with other people, again, in a post-election world. And I guess our post-election world will be particularly U.S. context.
Yeah.
But those, the way to do that would be to craft certain dispositions as habits of the heart and mind and body. And democratic. So I'll be talking about what is democracy, and what are the dispositions that are most conducive to it.
That's great. Thank you so much for being here, Leonard. It's great to talk with you.
And
grateful for your friendship.
Yes, likewise. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Starley Pratt. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips and Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.